I'll turn again then, please, to Genesis chapter 31 and the passage that we read there earlier on. And so we read then in the first two verses of our passage, Genesis 31, verse 22, on the third day Laban was told that Jacob had fled. Taking his relatives with him, he pursued Jacob. And as you read those words, you almost can't help feeling a little bit sorry for Jacob. Here he is, and he's on his way back to Canaan. He's on his way back home, and that is fantastic, of course. 6 years earlier, he would never have been able to envisage that possibility, the possibility of him being in that situation. Embarking on a long journey with a large family is an expensive business. And as we saw last time, at that point, 6 years earlier, Jacob was utterly penniless. He had just completed paying off a 14-year debt. And he didn't have so much as a single sheep or a single goat that he could call his own. Laban wasn't going to help him. He wasn't going to help finance a journey back to Canaan that would take away from him his daughters and his grandchildren and his hard-working servant, Jacob. He wasn't going to be of any assistance. And so, as we saw, Jacob seemed to be trapped there in Haran. There seemed no possibility of him setting off back to Canaan. But then, over those 6 years, God had come to Jacob's deliverance, and he had miraculously produced for Jacob those large and healthy flocks of animals, so that Jacob, 6 years down the line, was wealthy and economically self-sufficient enough to be able now to set off back home to Canaan. But if you thought it was all going to be simple now, if you thought it was all going to be downhill from there, you are wrong. Because here we read at the beginning of tonight's passage that Jacob, just a few days after Jacob had set off, Laban set off after him. And as I say, you almost can't help feeling sorry for Jacob here. It's like he's trapped in a vice, and the vice is being tightened. Ahead of him, presumably, in Canaan, is his brother Esau. And we don't know what kind of mood Esau is in with regard to Jacob. Because, of course, Jacob, 20 years earlier, had deeply offended Esau, stealing from him the blessing of his father Isaac. And so Jacob has that uninviting encounter ahead of him. That's getting nearer all the time. And yet behind him now, he has Laban pursuing him. And Laban too is offended because of the way that Jacob has left him, the way in which he left him without explaining to him that he was going and without saying goodbye to him. And so that encounter, that equally uninviting encounter, is also getting closer and closer all the time. Right, then Jacob is in the middle of this vice and the walls are closing in on him. Which is he going to have to contend with first? Is it going to be his offended brother Esau, or is it going to be his offended uncle and father-in-law Laban? It's all very dramatic. It's all very exciting. But as I say, you can't help feeling a little sorry for Jacob. Well, we know from our reading tonight which of these two encounters he has to experience first. Which of these two offended men he has to deal with first. It's Laban. Laban catches up with him. And so I just want to look at this passage this evening, this encounter between Jacob and his offended, angry uncle and father-in-law under three headings. First of all, confrontation. Confrontation in verses 22 to 29, because we're told then in verse 23 that Laban caught up with Jacob. We're told in verse 25 that Laban camped alongside Jacob. And then we're told in verse 26 that the two men came face to face. And Laban's approach is indeed distinctly confrontational. He effectively hurls at Jacob a barrage of the most accusatory language. What have you done? You've deceived me. Why did you run off? Why didn't you tell me? You didn't even let me kiss my grandchildren. You have done a foolish thing. And so on. A barrage, as I say, of the most accusatory language. And I just want to bring to your attention really two things in this connection. First of all, it's only a barrage of accusatory language. It's only a barrage of accusatory language. Laban doesn't physically assault Jacob here. He doesn't punch him in the face. He doesn't wring his neck. He doesn't pull out a sword on him. He doesn't resort to violence in any shape or form against his nephew and son-in-law, Jacob. Well, you say, what's the big deal of that? One would hope that he wouldn't. After all, he is Jacob's uncle and father-in-law. Surely it goes without saying that he wouldn't resort to violence against him. Well, that may be so, but I think that Laban left Haran in pursuit of Jacob with violence in his mind. Because he says, doesn't he, in verse 29, I have the power to harm you, but last night the God of your father said to me, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. If it hadn't been for that dream, Laban seems to be saying, I'd have kicked your head in by now. I'd have kicked the living daylights out of you by now if it hadn't been for that dream. But because then, of this dream, because of God's intervention here, because God stepped in and addressed Laban in his sleep, it was, as I say, only a barrage of accusatory language, not anything more that Jacob had to face. And I suppose what I find so intriguing about that is that if it hadn't been for the fact that Laban happened to drop in a reference to his dream in the middle of his speech to Jacob, there in verse 29. If it hadn't been for that, Jacob would never have known about the dream that Laban had had. And he would never have known about the violence, possibly even the death, that he had been spared from because of something specific that God had done for him the night before. And I think it's a wonderful reminder, isn't it, that so much of what God does for us, his children, so much of what God does on our behalf, 24/7, as our king and as our shepherd and as our father, goes unseen by us. Whether it's stern conversations with Satan himself, as in Job's experience. Remember Job there, in the first chapter. God said to Satan, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger. Job didn't know anything about that conversation. Or whether it's strange providences, as in the case of Mordecai in the book of Esther. Remember how amazing it was on that very night that Haman was approaching the king to speak to the king about Mordecai's execution. That very night, the king was reading in his records about some noble deed that Mordecai had performed on his behalf and was resolving in his mind to honor Mordecai. Mordecai didn't know anything about that. Or whether, as in Jacob's case, it's simply putting into the heads of our enemies the suggestion, the command to act differently from how they had originally planned to act toward us. In all kinds of ways, God acting on behalf of his people, protecting them, guarding them, keeping them, and yet it's all unseen to them. So often we think of ourselves, don't we, as such vulnerable people in a big bad world. We think of ourselves as just the helpless victims of random and unpredictable circumstances. This passage is reminding us that's not the case. It's not the case. Behind the scenes, we have an endlessly resourceful protector who is constantly at work doing things and pulling various strings which we could never even imagine in order to steer us safely through dangers and snares and pitfalls we perhaps never even knew existed. A sovereign protector we have, unchangeably faithful to save. We should rejoice tonight in this defender, this protector, this king, this shepherd, this father, who is working so tirelessly in keeping us, and yet so much of it is unseen to us. So it's only a barrage of accusatory language. But then the other thing I want you to notice is that it still is a barrage of accusatory language. It is a barrage of accusatory language. And what I'm getting at here is that it seems to me highly questionable whether Laban was in fact obeying the command that God had given him in his dream. Now, of course, the command that God had given him certainly had an influence on Laban. As we've just seen, it brought some restraint into his dealings with Jacob. It kept him from violence. But look at what the command to Laban was in the dream. Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And yet here's Laban pouring out this torrent of abuse upon Jacob. Well, how is that not saying anything to Jacob, either good or bad? And it seems to me that we have a classic example here of the way in which so often we distort God's commands in our own heads so that we think we're keeping God's commands. We think we're obeying God's commands, whereas in reality we've kind of moved God's goalposts. We've distorted the actual biblical command itself. So that when it comes, for instance, to how we use our tongues, so often we think that as long as we're not engaging in out-and-out character assassination, then we're keeping God's commands with regard to the use of our tongues. And yet God's command is, in a passage like 2 Corinthians 12, verse 20, it's against gossip even. It's not just about out-and-out character assassination. It's about even those little stories, those little anecdotes, those little comments that we pass on, which just have the slight intention of running someone else down and portraying them in a rather negative light. Or the way in which we think of adultery. And so often, again, as long as we're not engaging in a fully blown affair or in pornography or something like that, we think of ourselves as obeying God's command. And yet God's command in a place like the Sermon on the Mount is not even to look lustfully at a member of the opposite sex. It's not just about affairs and pornography and the rest of it. It's about even that fleeting, desiring glance as we're walking down the street. And so often I'm saying then we're a bit like Laban, who thought he was obeying God's command simply because he wasn't committing any violence against Jacob. Whereas in reality the command was, in actual fact, don't even say anything good or bad against Jacob. We must be careful that we're not distorting his commands and moving God's goalposts. So that's the first thing then, the confrontation. But secondly this evening, search. That's the second heading, search, in verses 30 to 42. Because, of course, Laban had two specific grievances against Jacob, didn't he? One of them was that Jacob had left him in such a kind of underhand and sneaky fashion. He hadn't come and said, look, I'm leaving now. He had just legged it while Laban was away shearing the sheep. And that, then, was one of his grievances, and that is the one that he expresses in those verses that we've just been looking at. But he had another grievance, and that, of course, was the theft of his household gods. And it's to this he comes in verse 30. Now you have gone off because you longed to return to your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? And this second grievance, of course, doesn't really disturb Jacob all that much because he's absolutely convinced that they haven't stolen Laban's gods. As we find out in verse 32, he's unaware that in actual fact his own dear wife Rachel has done this deed and taken the gods. And so Jacob is quite happy to say to Laban, look, you go and search the camp. You go and find your gods in my tents. And so Laban does that, and there's this wonderfully dramatic narrative here. The narrator just brilliantly kind of creating the suspense as Laban kind of goes into all the other tents before finally going into Rachel's tent. And it seems to me that in this narrative then of Laban searching for his gods in Jacob's tents, that two emphases come to the fore. The first is the uselessness of these gods. The uselessness of these gods. For one thing, they're useless from Laban's point of view, aren't they? Here they are, Laban's gods, and they've been stolen. They've gone missing. There's something so pathetic, it seems to me, about this spectacle here of Laban having to go in and out of all these tents looking for his gods. It's like you getting up one morning and you're going to start the day in prayer, and you're just about to do that, only to discover that God isn't there. God has gone missing. God has been stolen. And before you can pray to him, you have to go off and hunt for him. Well, it's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's stupid. You never even begin to imagine that scenario. And yet that is exactly the situation that Laban is in here with regard to his gods. They're just utterly, utterly useless. He goes away on a sheep shearing trip. He comes back home and his gods have gone missing. How useless are those kind of gods? But then they're useless from Rachel's perspective as well, aren't they? We said last week that Rachel here, the situation is she's about to step into the unknown. She's lived at home there in Haran all her life, but now she's about to set off with Jacob to his home, Canaan. The first time she's leaving Haran. It's all very scary for her. It's all very daunting. She's nervous. She's apprehensive about what this journey is going to involve and what her future life is going to involve. And so, although I'm sure at some level she was trusting in her husband's God, Jehovah, she just felt in these circumstances, she needed an additional crutch to lean on. She needed a bit of additional supernatural aid. And so she took her father's household gods. And yet here she is now, and she's only a few days into her journey. And these gods aren't proving any kind of crutch that she can lean on. They aren't proving any kind of additional supernatural aid for her. They're a liability more than anything else. Surely it's one of the primary functions of a god to hide you when you're in danger. And yet here's Rachel, and she's having to hide her gods. It's just ridiculous. They're just so useless. And it seems to me that there's just this wonderful touch, isn't there, in the climax of this section. If I can say this reverently, you almost wonder whether God is almost having a joke here at the expense of these gods. The way in which Rachel had hidden them. Verse 34. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them inside her camel's saddle and was sitting on them. Laban searched through everything in the tent but found nothing. Rachel said to her father, "Don't be angry, my lord, that I cannot stand up in your presence. I'm having my period." And I think probably that the point the narrator is trying to get across is that this is all these gods are worth. They're basically just Rachel's menstrual cloth. That's how good they are. That's how useful they are. That's the value that they are to her. There couldn't be a more ridiculous image than Rachel sitting there, having her period, sitting on this camel saddle on top of these gods of Laban. Useless. Utterly useless. Now, I suppose that we're not likely to find ourselves in exactly the same situation as Rachel, not likely to ever be tempted to steal some little images and physically take gods like she did. But whenever we are in a situation like Rachel, where we're apprehensive, we're daunted, we're perhaps stepping into the unfamiliar and the unknown, we're a little scared, and at that point, we kind of instinctively reach out for additional crutches alongside God. Whether it's our own kind of innate resources, our own innate gifts, our savings account in the bank, some superstitious rite or other, the side of bed we get out of in the morning or whatever it might be. When we do that, are we not effectively doing the same thing as Rachel did? Taking her father's gods. Just that little bit of extra support, that little bit of extra comfort when you're in a crisis. Yes, she was trusting in Jehovah, but she needed just a little bit more as well. Well, when we do that, the outcome will be the same as for Rachel. We will find those additional crutches, no crutches at all. They'll snap. And they'll prove as useless as hers did. They will just be a liability to us, as those gods were to Rachel. So that's the first emphasis that comes to the fore, the uselessness of these gods. But the other emphasis that comes to the fore in this search is the grace of God. The grace of God. Rachel had sinned here. She had done wrong. I suppose she had committed theft, and more seriously, she had committed idolatry. And God could have publicly exposed her for these sins. He could have publicly exposed her as an idolatrous thief or a thieving idolater. He could have arranged things so that when Laban went into that final tent, he found the gods. He wasn't fooled by Rachel's excuse about having a period, and he searched a bit harder and he found them there in the camel's saddle. God could have arranged it like that. And if he had done, then, as I say, Rachel would have been publicly exposed for what she had done, and she would have had to pay all the consequences. But God doesn't do that. God doesn't allow her here to be publicly exposed. It's as if he keeps this matter as a matter between himself and Rachel alone. You know how parents, if they in a public place with their children, and their children start playing up, rather than just giving them a row there in the room where there's all these people and disciplining them there, they'll take them out, won't they, into a more private context, and there they'll discipline their children. And it's almost as if God is doing that here with Rachel, not exposing her publicly before Laban and Jacob and all the others, but just dealing with this in a very private and a very familial manner. And I suppose this is particularly highlighted because of the contrast with Jacob. Look at Jacob's words in verse 32 when Laban has first mentioned the theft of these gods. And he says, if you find anyone who has your God, he shall not live. And there's such a kind of recklessness about Jacob. So impetuous. Just immediately kind of waving his sword around and talking about death and killing the person who has done this. And yet by contrast with God, there's such a kind of calm restraint here, refusing to come down on Rachel like a ton of bricks. It reminds me of that passage in 1 Chronicles chapter 20. It's 1 Chronicles 21. You may or may not be familiar with that passage. David has angered God by arranging a census of his fighting men. And it's a little bit enigmatic, the whole context, but clearly he shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have arranged this census of his fighting men. Presumably it was an act of unnecessary hubris on his part. And God, as I say, is angry about this. And he sends his prophet Gad to David to almost negotiate David's punishment with him. And Gad says this to David. He says in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 11, this is what the Lord says, take your choice. This is your choice of punishments. 3 years of famine, 3 months of being swept away before your enemies with their swords overtaking you, or 3 days of the sword of the Lord. And this is David's response in verse 13. David said to Gad, I am in deep distress. Let me fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is very great, but do not let me fall into the hands of men. David chooses to fall into God's hands rather than men's hands. And here you get the impression that Rachel is much safer in God's hands than she is in Jacob's hands, in Jacob's sword-brandishing hands. And it seems to me a wonderful enactment of some of the words we were singing just now in Psalm 103. While Jacob immediately flared up with anger here, if anyone's done this, he shall not live. God is slow to anger. While Jacob makes absolutely no concession here to human weakness in this situation, God remembers that we are dust. While Jacob here can only think in terms of retribution, God does not treat us as our sins deserve. It's a wonderful little illustration, I think, of the grace of our God, his dealings here with his errant child, Rachel. So we've seen then confrontation, we've seen search, but thirdly and finally, agreement. Agreement in verses 43 to 55. Because, of course, in these verses, we have this covenant being made between Laban and Jacob. It's Laban who initiates the covenant. He says, doesn't he, in verse 44, "Come now, let's make a covenant, you and I, and let it serve as a witness between us." And I just want to just look quickly at the significance of this covenant for Laban and the significance of this covenant for Jacob. First of all, its significance for Laban. Laban, as I say, is the initiator here. He's the one who suggests this covenant. And it seems to me that he does so in order to protect two specific interests. First of all, to protect his family. Look at what he says in verses 48 to 50. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me today." Then verse 49, "May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. If you will treat my daughters, or if you take any wives besides my daughters, even though no one is with us, remember that God is a witness between you and me." And so that's the first interest that this covenant is protecting for Jacob, his family, his daughters, who are now going away. They're going to be out of his range, out of his sight, and part of this covenant is that they will be protected. And I don't know whether it strikes you, but it strikes me that there's just something terribly, terribly hypocritical about this. Here's Laban saying, "If you ill treat my daughters, or if you take any wives besides my daughters, may this be a witness between you and me." Now, who was it that was the cause of Jacob marrying more than one wife in the first place? It was Laban. It was he who had sneaked in Leah into the deal when it was Rachel that Jacob was supposed to be being married to. Laban was the one who had imposed these other wives on Jacob, and yet here's Laban now saying to Jacob, "You make sure that you don't go and marry other wives." Francis Schaeffer used to talk about this kind of imagined scenario. Imagine if God put a tape recorder around our necks. He was obviously speaking in an earlier period than our own. We don't use tape recorders anymore. But he's saying, imagine God put a tape recorder around our necks. And this tape recorder, it only picked up those occasions when we say to someone, "You should do this," or "You shouldn't do that," "You should do this," "You shouldn't do that." And then imagine that when it came to Judgment Day, God said, "Right, I'm not going to read out my law in your presence. I'm not going to apply my law to you. I'm not going to judge you according to my law. I'm simply going to judge you according to your own law, according to your own code, according to all those you shoulds and you shouldn'ts that you've said throughout your life." And Schaeffer's point was that even if that was all God's judgment was, then we would find ourselves utterly without a leg to stand on. Because we're always telling other people what they should and shouldn't do, and yet we're doing and not doing those same things ourselves. And we see that with Laban here, don't we? Here's the man who had imposed these wives on Jacob, and here he is telling Jacob not to marry other wives. And it's something we must all be very careful of, isn't it? We must all make sure that we're not hypocrites who have planks in our own eyes and are constantly pointing out specks in other people's eyes. It's very easy to slip into a sense of self-righteousness that really feels that someone else is much worse than us. Laban probably was quite sincere here. He just didn't see the hypocrisy here. He didn't think, "Yes, but what did I do to Jacob back then? I imposed a second wife on him." And we must be careful we're not hypocritical like that. But then the second interest that this covenant was protecting for Laban was his territory. If you carry on from verse 51, Laban also said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar I have set up between you and me. This heap is a witness and this pillar is a witness that I will not go past this heap to your side to harm you, and that you will not go past this heap and pillar to my side to harm me. And so Laban is concerned then that Jacob is going to kind of at some point invade his territory, and that's why he introduces this second stipulation. It seems to me that in this case, Laban has been, I suppose, self-pityingly paranoid. Jacob hasn't got any interest whatsoever in invading Laban's land. Jacob for 20 years has been kind of just longing and yearning to get out of Haran and get back to Canaan. That's all that's on Jacob's radar. He just wants to get home. He wants to be able to claim God's promise and settle peacefully in his homeland, in the land of his fathers in Canaan. He's not interested in stealing parts of Haran from Laban. And yet, Laban here, there's just something so self-pityingly paranoid about him. He has this kind of victim complex. He feels that the whole world is against him. You get a sense of this, don't you? This kind of self-pity. Back in verse 43, where he says, the women are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, all you see is mine, yet what can I do today about these daughters of mine? The guy's wallowing in self-pity. And here then, he just feels that everyone is out to take what is his. Everyone is out to get at him. Everyone is out to harm him. He just suspects that as soon as Jacob has gone out of his sight, he'll be turning around and coming back and attacking him and taking his territory from him. And again, I think this is something that we all need to watch out for. I think this is one of the subtlest forms of pride and self-absorption and self-obsession that we can easily fall into. We often associate pride, don't we, with someone who's going around kind of boasting about themselves all the time. And that, to be sure, is one form of pride. But there's this form of pride, this self-pity, this kind of paranoia that senses that the world is against us all the time, that we're the victims of everyone else. And we always need to remember we're following in the footsteps of a Saviour who emptied himself. And part, I think, of emptying ourselves is ridding ourselves of these elements of self-pity and paranoia. So that's the significance of this agreement for Laban, protecting these two interests. And we've seen the lessons from that. But then its significance for Jacob. And I think its significance for Jacob is really this, that it's almost a rebuke to Jacob. Because this, as we saw at the end of last week's sermon, this really is how Jacob should have left things himself when he left Haran. He should have been the one at that time making a covenant, making an agreement with Laban. He should have been the one being quite above board about the whole thing and saying, look, Laban, God has blessed me. He has given me all these flocks and all this wealth over these past 6 years. God has enabled me now to leave this place, and I'm going to do this properly. I'm going to say goodbye to you, and I'm going to make an agreement with you. And all this is going to be decent and seemly and appropriate. He should have been the one suggesting the covenant back then at the point that he left Haran. And it's almost, I think, a rebuke to him that he has to be pursued by Laban. And it's Laban that has to impose this agreement upon their relationship. You see, if we just step back a moment and look at the big picture here, what's happening is that Jacob is leaving Haran and he's effectively on his way to Bethel. Remember how God had promised him back there in chapter 28, in that first dream, that he would bring him back to Bethel. And Jacob had, on his part, promised God that he would then worship him. He would give him a tenth of all his possessions there at Bethel. So that's what everything is gearing towards here. Jacob is heading now toward Bethel. so that he can fulfill this vow that he had made to God, so that he can go and build the altar that he wanted to build back then and offer God the worship that he wanted to offer God back then. And that will finally happen in chapter 35. Jacob will arrive at Bethel and he will worship God in the way that he so wanted to do. But you see, it's almost as if before he can do that, before he gets to Bethel, before he gets to the altar, before he gets to the worship, he has to put things right with those men whom he has offended. Here, first of all, with Laban, and then in the next chapter, with Esau. And that's why this had to happen. Laban had to pursue him. Jacob had left on the wrong footing. He had left causing offense. He had left without there being a proper relationship established between these two men. And Laban had to pursue him then in order that the two men might be reconciled. And Jacob could then continue on to the next stage of his journey to Bethel, reconciled to his offended uncle and father-in-law. It seems to me that these chapters are a wonderful illustration of a New Testament principle, the one that our Lord himself speaks of in Matthew chapter 5, verse 23. If you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. Before Jacob can offer his gifts at Bethel's altar, he has to be reconciled to those men he has offended. Esau, yes, but first of all, Laban. And I wonder tonight, are we trying to kind of week by week go on worshipping God while all the time there's this huge anomaly in our lives, because there are men with whom we need to be reconciled? Let's make sure that before we work on the vertical, we have put right the horizontal, and that we are in proper Christian agreement with those brothers and sisters that we have offended. Amen.